This is music from Richard Davis. Welcome to The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson. It's no coincidence that the bassist is on some of the greatest jazz sessions of all time. Recordings by the Jackie Byard Experience, Booker Ervin, Eric Dolphy's Out to Lunch, and Andrew Hill's Black Fire. Davis is honored for those musical contributions and many more. Find out what the 2014 National Endowment for the Arts Jazzmaster has to say. Play along with Jamie Abersold, also a 2014 NEA Jazzmaster. The indefatigable teacher shares a little secret anyone can improvise. But first, a preview of the 10th Annual Winter Jazz Festival with NPR's Patrick Jaren-Watananen. That's up next. This is The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson. Thanks for checking in. The Winter Jazz Festival invades New York, January 7th through 11th. 9 different venues, all in New York's Greenwich Village. And this is the 10th incarnation of the Winter Jazz Festival. Patrick Jaren-Watananen from NPR Music joins me. I mean, just over the last few years alone, Patrick, we've seen this thing grow into sort of a juggernaut. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely.
I remember when this thing was at the Knitting Factory many, many years ago. I was there for the first couple of years. And I mean, I don't know how the presenters, Bryce Rosenblum and some folks, how they even broke even, if they even broke even. Now, certainly, there is some kind of galvanized force around this because it's now part of something larger. We have a Jazz Connect conference in New York. We have the APAP Presenters Conference, which is presenters from across the United States and even some from Europe who come in. And WBGO and NPR Music will be at Le Poisson Rouge for the Friday and Saturday evening affairs, and we'll be bringing you some music. Stay tuned for more information about that. You'll see me on stage, Josh Jackson, at Le Poisson Rouge over those 2 nights. I'll also be part of the Blue Note 75th Anniversary program at the Town Hall with Jason Moran and Robert Glasper and Ravi Coltrane and lots of other great artists. So there's a whole lot going on. I want to talk about some of the performers that we're excited about hearing during Winter Jazz Festival, Patrick. Tell me one of them.
Here's music by a clarinetist, actually, named Ben Goldberg, and he's put together a band called Unfold Ordinary Mind. They actually made a record that released in 2013, a record that I really like. It's got 2 different saxophonists who sort of handle the melodic duties, and Nels Klein is on guitar. And Ben here plays the bass clarinet, and he uses the bass clarinet as a bass instrument. Here's a tune called XCPF.
CPF, Ben Goldberg from Unfold Ordinary Mind, self-release recording. Ben Goldberg will be appearing at the Winter Jazz Festival. That's what we're talking about, some of the bands and music that we're looking forward to hearing. There's so much of it. Patrick Jaren-Watananen from NPR Music joins us. I'm following the drummers this year, Patrick, and I'll start with a record that's coming out very soon on OK Records, and it's drummer Jeff Ballard and his trio. Let's hear Beat Street. Street. Drummer Jeff Ballard and his trio, Miguel Zanon on saxophone, Lionel Loeke on guitar. It's a recording coming out on OK Records. It's called Time's Tales. Great to hear Jeff Ballard making a recording. And this trio has been doing a lot of performances. They did one at Berklee College of Music. They've done some dates in Europe. And it will be very much exciting to hear this group performing in New York.
We'll stick with the drummers, Guillermo E. Brown. He's a drummer on this recording and also designed some of the electronics, and Christoph Panzani is on sax and Keith Witte on bass. Their band together is called Thiefs. Not Thieves, V-E-S, but Thiefs, T-H-I-E-F-S.
Thiefs, T-H-I-E-F-S, and that's the name of the recording, it's the name of the band, and that tune was called what, Patrick?
That tune is called Doot, slash S, I guess, so, you know, I don't really speak French, but I believe it's Doubt slash S, so plural Doubt.
No doubt there's a lot of good music at Winter Jazz Fest. As I follow the drummers and keep the drummer thread going, I really want to hear beat music. Mark Giuliano. This one's called Public Interest. Public Interest, beat music, Mark Giuliano. Mark Giuliano is becoming an in-demand cat these days. I mean, playing with Brad Meldow as part of Meliana, and we're to expect a recording in 2014 from that duo. But just about everyone I know, when they want to have almost this metronomic sound on drums, but with real feeling, they ask for Mark Giuliano.
When you follow the drummers, you can also follow the sort of pulses of modern rhythm, and I want to bring up another recording. This is by Michelle Rosewoman, the piano player. Last year, she recorded this great album called New Yoruba. It's sort of a recording that's been 30 years in the making, right? So when she first came to New York, she was embedded in, you know, deep Afro-Cuban mystical Santeria studies, and also this progressive jazz tradition, and sort of found a way to meld them.
claro lo juro, so que volá. Su lo lo mío. Oh lo lo tu tu mami. Oh moya la wana mama Kenya.
Michelle Rosewoman with Divine Passage, Elegua, from New Yoruba, a musical celebration of Cuba in America. That's a recording that Michelle Rosewoman released herself. We're talking about music featured at the 10th anniversary of the Winter Jazz Festival in New York. On the checkout, I'm Josh Jackson. Patrick Jaren-Watananan from NPR Music joins us, and we continue with the drummers. Here's a recording that's coming out in 2014. This is a guy who has been making a lot of recordings sound really good, and a lot of musicians. Dave Douglas, Bill Frisell. I mean, the list sort of goes on and on. There's a recording called 303 coming out. That's the area code for Denver, Colorado, and that's where the drummer Rudy Royston comes from. Bones from 303, Rudy Royston. And Rudy Royston will appear at Le Poisson Rouge. And one more recording to leave out with. You like Jamie Baum, so do we.
Jamie Baum is a flute player who lives in New York, but has been traveling throughout the world as a delegate for the U.S. State Department. You know, the U.S. State Department has a long history of diplomatic jazz missions. She's been to South America, to India, to Sri Lanka, to the Maldives, to Thailand, to Bangladesh, and this is one of the tunes that came out of her travels there. This one is dedicated to Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, and this is called Nusrat.
We're talking about music from the Winter Jazz Festival here in New York. This is the 10th anniversary. I'm very much looking forward to this. I mean, I just sort of, you know, float through this as best as I can, because I don't know any other way to take all this in, Patrick, do you?
I would just say go with the flow. Go with what people are talking about that sounds interesting. And if that place happens to be sold out or particularly overcrowded, go to a different place. Knowing the caliber of musicians who are invited to Winter Jazz Fest, you might just stumble upon something really great.
Patrick Jaren-Watananan from NPR Music, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you at the Winter Jazz Festival.
Absolutely. Looking forward to coming up for it.
Check out all of the shows, including Friday and Saturday's marathon concerts, at winterjazzfest.com. Coming up next, Jamie Abersol's Secret to Life. Pick up an instrument and play a little jazz. This is The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson. Thank you.
Concert B-flat tuning note.
Jamie Ebersole, thank you for joining us on the checkout, and congratulations for your being named an NEA Jazz Master Fellow. Boy, is this some kind of surprise for you? I mean, do you ever expected that this day would come?
No, I never expected this day. And when the fella called, I thought he was trying to sell me something. And then he said, well, this is, Mr. Ebersole, this is not a solicitation. I'm calling from the NEA. And then he said the rest of it. I said, oh, my. Just to think about my name being with all of my jazz greats, and I've got their records and CDs and everything. It's different.
Did you ever suspect at any point, Jamie, that you would have the impact? Have you ever really truly begun the assessment of your entire body of work over your career and what that has meant to, you know, countless young improvisers?
Not really. I think if I had stopped, then I would look back at it, but I'm still going, if you know what I mean. I'm still thinking ahead, still playing, playing jobs, trying to practice, thinking, writing tunes, answering letters, et cetera, et cetera. So I feel like I'm still in the middle of all of it. So I haven't really had time to assess, although I get a lot of letters and a lot of emails and things from people all around the world, basically, thanking me for putting out the jazz educational stuff and the play-alongs, so they've got somebody to play with. So it's had a big impact, I know that.
This is Jamie Ebersole, and I like to play on the piano the first 20 examples out of the Volume 1 booklet. I'm going to start with example number 1 on page 10. I'll play the F minor, the Dorian minor scale, in whole notes up the scale, and then we'll move ahead to the other ones.
Do you feel like over the course of time these collections that you've put together have really helped to sort of demystify the art of improvisation?
Oh, definitely, yes. Definitely, yes. But it's better if I'm there in person or a human and working with the combo or the big band or whoever's taking the solos to encourage them to go ahead and give it a try, you know. I was in China about 2 months ago, and I worked with 8 different combos at the Shanghai Conservatory of Music, and there was an all-girl group of 5 girls, and they were all in their early 20s, and they all played fine, but the electric bass player, she didn't want to take a solo. She just refused, said she couldn't, you know. So I gave her a Duke Ellington quarter. I said, now here's a very famous quarter. You hang on to this, and this is going to be a collector's item later on. Of course, someone was translating for me. So I encouraged her to solo, and she did. And I think everybody applauded afterwards. Well, we got into our second tune, and everybody soloed, and we came down to the bass player, and she didn't even question it this time. She just dove right in. So I said, well, I'm sure glad I said what I said on that first tune, and I encouraged her to give it a try, because this could be a changing point in her life as far as playing the bass, you know?
Very cool. Jamie Ebersole joins us on the checkout. He's an NEA Jazz Master. And it's hard to imagine sometimes when we think about sort of the centers of activity for jazz music. You know, everyone always talks about New York and Chicago and New Orleans. The truth be told, there's this little town right across the Ohio from Louisville, Kentucky, that, you know, and a little ranch house where there's quite a bit of activity going on.
Out here, all they talk about is New Albany as being the jazz center of the world. But it's actually serious. I mean, the people around here that know me, you know, they think of jazz. They're not necessarily jazz aficionados, but they think of me as being jazz. And we go out and we play a lot of fundraising things and so forth where we don't charge the groups for money. So they're definitely hearing jazz around here. But you're right. Originally, I wanted to go to New York and make a Blue Note record. New York was the place to go. I wanted to go to the Manhattan School of Music. I wrote them a letter. And they wrote me back a couple months later and said, Dear Mr. Ebersole, we don't offer the saxophone. So that was the end of that. So I ended up going to Indiana University, and which is about 100 miles from here. And then I came back here to New Albany because there wasn't anywhere else to go. And I'd just gotten married, so I worked at my dad's florist in the mornings and afternoon. Then I started teaching privately in the afternoon. And one thing led to another. And then about 5, 6, 7 years later, I put out the first play-along record just because I wanted something to practice with, you know, piano, bass, and drums. And I think I might have put the record out first, and then thought, wow, I need a book with this, because if people buy this LP and nobody's soloing, they're going to feel like they got gypped. So I labored with the book for a while, and then we put the two things out together, the book and the LP. And I took it around some bookstores and put a little ad in Downbeat magazine finally. And that was the beginning back there in about 1967. But I had no idea that I would put out a volume two, let alone volume 133, and be thinking about what I'm going to do for volume 134.
Let's talk about some very, just hard numbers. How many of these have you sold?
Oh, wow, I don't know. People have asked me that before. I've never really thought about it, but I guess it's got to be, what, millions? I mean, we've been doing it for 40 years. You know, some sell real well. Others don't sell very much at all. But we sold a lot, you know, hundreds of thousands of CDs, LPs, and cassettes all around the world. And the good thing is it's allowed people to play music that they wouldn't have had the opportunity to play otherwise with a piano, bass, and drums, or sometimes a guitar.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
I recorded three tunes for you with my play-alongs here. So I set up the mics 2 days ago, and I said, okay, let's see how easy or difficult this is. Well, it was much more difficult than I thought.
Why is that?
Well, there's you lack the interaction, number one, and number two, you got the pressure of we're going to play for 4 or 5 minutes solid, improvise, play the melody once, and then improvise for another four and a half minutes, hopefully without any mistakes or any flaws. And there's the psychological thing of doing that. My mindset was, I've got to come up with three really good tracks here, and that just stymies sometimes, not necessarily your creativity, but it puts you on edge, and I'm not used to being on edge like that. I'm used to just improvising and playing.
Let's hear a taste of that. We're going to hear you playing How High the Moon. This is from Volume 6, and it's you with Kenny Barron on piano, Ron Carter on bass, and Ben Riley on drums.
Thank you.
Jamie Ebersol joins us on The Checkout, an NEA jazz master and creator of the Play Along series that has been influential to countless young improvisers for more than four decades. Let's go back to Volume 1 and tell me a little bit about the scenario with Rufus Reed and Jonathan Higgins on bass and drums, respectively, and you're playing the piano.
Right. Actually, that one that I played with the B-flat Blues was about maybe the third time that we'd recorded that. We first did it in 1967 up in Bloomington, Indiana at a music store because they had a grand piano. And I remember having to stop the recording once or twice because a freight train was going by the building outside and rumbling the building. And we used that recording for some years, and then we did another one. And then the one with Jonathan Higgins and Rufus Reed, I think we did in the early 90s. So we've been selling that one for over 20 years. And I might add that if it hadn't been for Miles Davis's 1958 recording, the So What, using the two scales, the D Dorian minor and the E flat Dorian minor, we may not be having this conversation today. And the reason I say that is in about 1960 or 61, I was given private lessons in Seymour, Indiana, little 30-minute lessons. And this girl came in one day and she finished her flute lesson a little early. So I said, there's a piano in the room. I said, let me play some D minor here. I'll just walk a bass line, play some chords, and I want you on your flute to just improvise in D minor, no sharps and no flats. So she dove in and she improvised and she sounded really good. And I was really surprised because she had no interest in jazz, had never heard it before, but she sounded like she was playing exactly what she heard in her head, which for some reason really surprised me. So then I asked her to change keys. We did another key and she did just fine. Then I asked some other students later in the day to do the same thing. And I was surprised that the two or three people I asked, the young teenagers, they could actually, without ever having done it before, they could actually improvise the phrases that they heard in their head. Now, they weren't the jazziest phrases in the world, and they didn't play jazz licks, but I could tell that they were improvising. So that got me thinking, I wonder if everybody can improvise. And that's why I now say anyone can improvise, because I know they can.
What makes a good improviser to you, Jamie Ebersol?
What makes a good improviser? That's someone that plays what they hear in their head. That's the first thing, number one. Because I find most often with beginners, and even some that have been doing it for a long time, they're not playing what they hear in their head. They're just letting their fingers ramble, and it just doesn't make any sense. Once they finish their two or three choruses of blues or whatever they're playing, the listener can't remember one thing they played because they're not speaking a language that is identifiable.
One, two, three, four.
Talk about body and soul. You do a version of this with some longtime colleagues here. Talk about these gentlemen on piano, bass, and drums.
Well, Ed Sof and Dan Hurley, we started out together years ago, probably 40 years ago, doing summer camps together. And John Goolsbee, the bass player, he joined us much later. But Ed and Rufus Reed, David Baker, Jerry Coker, and Dan Hurley, we all started kind of together way back there. We thought that if we did this right, that jazz education would invade the school system around America, and we'd have a whole bunch of people enjoying improvisation for the rest of their life, whether they played in a band or not. But that didn't really happen, so the need for the summer jazz workshops around the country continues, because what we thought was going to happen didn't happen, which was that the colleges would encourage improvisation, playing jazz and so forth, learning the songs, learning the licks and the patterns, and encouraging people to play what they hear in their head. But that really hasn't happened. It's happened at several of the colleges around the country, but not like we thought it would.
Are you disappointed?
Oh, yes. I'm very disappointed, yes. I think we all are. Not that we were hoping everybody else would take hold of it and then we wouldn't have anything to do, but we just thought the whole idea of being creative and imaginative with music is so exciting that everybody that gets a taste of it would like to do it. And that's where, incidentally, that's where the play-alongs came in, something to practice with. There's not a second of every day that goes by where somebody around the world isn't practicing with one of my play-along records. And they could be in their basement or their den, or they might be out on the street, you know, with their horn case open, hoping people put $5 in it. or might be on a mountaintop or in a jungle or who knows what. But that's the reason that's happening is jazz is still kind of like a lost art, so to speak.
Body and Soul. Jamie Ebersold, creator of summer jazz camps and education materials and play-along discs, and has been recognized as an advocate for jazz by the National Endowment for the Arts. What's the one song you go back and listen to the most?
One song? No, I don't have one song. The first one that comes to mind right now is This I Dig of You with
Hank Mobley.
Yeah. Soul Station album. That's one. Another one that just came to mind was My Funny Valentine with Miles and Ron Carter and George Coleman at the NAACP thing where the guy shouts, someone in the audience shouts way into it. It was a surprise the first time I heard it. And every time I listen to it since, I wait for the shout.
Don't you think in some small way that's sort of the role of the musician, Jamie Ebersold, to make someone sort of shout, whether it be viscerally and out loud or just sort of, you know, somewhere deep in the recesses of, you know, someone feeling something.
I think the feeling someone something is what I've been about. Because, you know, I don't see it and I don't hear it, but I know it goes on in people's dens and their bedrooms and their garages and their basement when they're playing with a play-along record, for instance. They finally achieve something that they wanted to do. It might be just as simple as keeping their place for four or five choruses and actually ending the track at the right time. And they give a shout, you know, or they think, wow, I did it. Okay, so if I did it once, can I do it a second time? I think that's where the play-alongs come in. They allow these people to enjoy music in various different ways in the privacy of their home. The idea of them ever getting out and playing publicly for money or for just enjoyment, it may never happen to them. But the fact that these CDs and the old LPs and the cassettes, and some people still use cassettes, I deal with a lot. I correspond with a whole lot of prisoners, And a lot of the prisons do not allow CDs or anything like that. They still use cassettes. So from time to time, I'll be running off a play-along and putting it on cassette, wrapping it up in a clear case with no screws. That's some of the prison rules. And send it off to somebody in a prison so they can practice in their cell or out in the yard with whatever and just enjoy music. So I think that's a lot of what I've been about. Haven't thought a lot about it that way, but I can see the results from time to time when people write or when they call.
A very meta moment. NEA Jazz Master Jamie Abersol playing along with himself on B-flat Blues from his very first play-along, How to Play Jazz and Improvise, Volume 1. Discover all of Abersol's play-alongs, there are 133 of them, at jazzbooks.com. Coming up next, 2014 NEA Jazz Master Richard Davis. This is The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Richard Davis, congratulations on this honor of being named an NEA Jazz Master. If you can choose one recording featuring Richard Davis, what would it be?
Summertime.
Why do you choose that?
Well, I was very happy to do the recording. It turns out that it was me and Elvin Jones, and we were supposed to be joined by a guitarist. I can't think of his name now. And he didn't show up. So the producer, Bob Thiel, said, just start playing something. And so I just started playing that melody.
Heavy Sounds from Richard Davis and Elvin Jones.
That's the name of the album, Heavy Sounds.
Talk to me, if you would, about the trio that you were with Jackie Byard and Alan Dawson.
That was a magnificent rhythm section. It was everything that a bass player would want to have happen, and I'm sure we all felt the same about each other. Alan Dawson was a magnificent, imaginative technician, and everything he did was clean as a whistle. Jackie Byard, he could play the history of the piano in about 12 bars. His technique was flawless. His in and out of music, by that I mean playing in a standard way and in a non-standard way, was just superb.
Richard Davis, I want to talk specifically about, out of those Booker Irvin records, you know, they're all like the books. And I think if I had to choose a favorite, it would be the Freedom Book from December of 1963. Now that's 50 years ago, but there's a song on there called A Day to Mourn. And I know that it has a particular story that relates to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Can you tell me about the circumstances of being in the studio? And I mean, was that something that was inside your mind as you were playing that song?
I must have had something on my mind, having our great leader assassinated. I remember being in a studio other than the one you're talking about, where I was heavily mourning that lost, but I don't remember that particular date as you relate to it. But I'm sure, because of the way I felt about Martin Luther King, that I must have mourned for about 3 years. And I thought that the whole country was mourning. We are still mourning, because we have not accomplished his dream.
What do you mean by that, we haven't accomplished his dream? What about it isn't fully realized for you, Richard Davis?
It's not fully realized by multitudes of people. People that he knew that he could be a leader for. But some of them weren't thinking in that same way. When a great leader like Martin Luther King comes along, the word leader means he's all by himself. I don't mean physically all by himself, but he stands alone, and he knows his days are numbered, because anyone who comes into being that good feels that someone there is going to erase him from the universe.
Richard Davis, an NEA jazz master, I'll say two words, and I bet that they'll conjure an image for you. Black fire.
Is that Andrew Hill?
Yes, sir. Talk to me about recording that record with Andrew Hill, with Joe Henderson, with Roy Haynes, and you are in the bass chair.
Well, Andrew was one of the first guys I worked with in Chicago. We used to go to these neighborhoods where the mafia controlled it, and we stayed on the stage so long, I asked Andrew, when is the job over? He said, whenever they say we can go home. So I've been a person all my life who never liked to be controlled. So I went in the mission, I took my bass back to my car. On the next intermission, I took the bass to the car and drove off. If they had seen me packing that bass, they might have said something. I told Andrew, don't you ever call me again. I'm glad he didn't pay me attention, because some of my best moments in music was with Andrew. Andrew had a genius in him that even now I'm just beginning to realize.
Richard Davis, every year you hold a conference as part of your Madison, Wisconsin Institute for the Healing of Racism. And I just wonder a couple of things. First of all, where does music fit into all of this? You know, what kind of potential does a song have? Like, where is the power in that as it relates to actually being a spiritual healing force in your mind?
Well, let's say it this way. In my own answer, I have spent many years collecting music that represents protest music. The recordings made as far back as 1920, and still today, that talks about protest. It can either be done with words that are coded, it could be done with words that are very specific, and it could be done with no words at all, just through instrumentation. And the protest is there. I have roughly 90-minute tapes. Each one is 90 minutes of protest music. Duke Ellington was one of the greatest sociologists ever was, besides being a musician. You know a piece called Jump for Joy?
Oh, absolutely. Jump for Joy, yes.
That's protest.
How so?
Do you know the lyrics?
Tell me the lyrics.
I can't tell you all of the lyrics, but the ones that move me the most and stays indelible in my mind, Jump for Joy means that the slaves were being freed, or before that, they were slaves, and when slavery was emancipated, so to speak, they were jumping for joy. Because in the lyrics of the song, no more hounds at my heels.
Fare thee well, land of cotton. Cotton Lyle is out of style. Honey child, jump for joy. Don't you grieve, little Eve. All the hounds, I do believe, have been killed. Ain't you thrilled? Jump for joy. Have you seen pastures groovy? Oh, green pastures was just a Technicolor movie. When you stop up to heaven and you meet old St. Pete, tell that boy to jump for joy. Step right in, give Pete some skin and jump for joy.
That is protest music. As protest music has been going on for tons of years. I don't know how many people pay attention to that, because the cry of black people goes unheard.
You've provided an example of a protest song from, I think it's the 1940s, if I'm not mistaken. What's a more modern protest song that you can recall that's part of your mixtape?
Well, you know the name Marcellus.
Oh, sure. Which
one? The one who plays the saxophone?
Branford.
He talks about taxi cab drivers passing him up on the street in New York.
Taxi! Taxi!
Where you going?
Yeah, man, Brooklyn.
No.
Oh,
people
come on, man. Don't
Brooklyn,
start that,
no.
Man. What you guys always do that to
Brooklyn,
us, man?
No,
we sit for 15
no,
minutes,
man.
Sorry. Come
yeah,
on, what does it take, man?
You have money?
Yeah, man. Come on, man. Brooklyn! Say taxi! Man, God damn!
Brother trying to get a cab, yeah.
Yeah. But there are many stories like that. I'm getting ready to go to New York very soon. In the back of my mind, am I going to be refused a taxi? So those things are like implanted. It's like post-traumatic slave syndrome. Your mentality tells you at any time you can be put in your place. Even though I'm going to get one of the greatest awards in New York, all cab drivers don't know about that. To see a black person and they register a thought.
Let's talk about 1977 and the decision to leave New York City, but let's draw it into focus with some other things that we're talking about as it relates to racism and institutional racism. Irrespective of the fact that you are being acknowledged by this country as an NEA jazz master, which is the most honorific title an improvising musician can achieve from the government here, do you feel that in some sense there is institutional racism in what we call jazz?
Oh, sure. Definitely. If you look at the big sellers of recordings in this country, I'm talking about some big bucks. Do you see any jazz artists in that category?
I'm afraid I don't, no.
That is right there. I could elaborate on that and go further.
Please.
Well, I hate to be redundant in the sense of saying why, but it's a music that has not been honored with the funds and monies that it deserves. Some people do not give the respect to the jazz musician who has created the music credit for his sustainment.
What are your thoughts, Richard Davis, about something like Louis Armstrong? What did I do to be so black and blue? My only sin is my skin.
He said it like it is. He said it like it is. As a matter of fact, this Reverend Alex D., he gave a speech at the Rotary Club, and the woman walked up to him and said, I like your presentation. And she said, I'm glad to see, to feel that you're not an angry black man. And then he said, but I am. See, some people want black people to make them comfortable. And don't tell me anything that upsets me and bothers me, because then you're making me uncomfortable. So that's what is called white privilege.
You don't sound like an angry black man, Richard Davis. I mean, is there a difference between vigilance of some kind and anger?
I am an angry black man. I contain that type of energy because it scares people and they won't listen to you when you throw out anger. It's like anybody having an argument. If two people start screaming at each other about something, nobody's listening. I believe in all of us, no matter what race, work together to make things better for everybody. Because anybody who exhibits white supremacy is caught up in a trap. And they cannot escape that until they make a dedication toward humanistic advancement.
Call him to bed. Spring's heart is lead. Feel like old Ned. Wish I was dead. What did I do to be so black and blue?
So, am I an angry black man? Sure, I'm angry. I'm very successful. I'm upper middle class. That doesn't mean anything unless the guy down the street who has nothing of what I have is treated fairly. I never let that blind me of saying I've made it. You go get yours. Martin Luther King said, if you don't impart knowledge that you have, why have it? I'm 83 years old. I can't retire until I see some changes that makes me feel that things are really, really changing.
Richard Davis, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
The Hill by the David Murray Trio, drummer Joe Chambers, and 2014 NEA Jazz Master, bassist Richard Davis. Did you know The Checkout is a podcast? Subscribe to us on iTunes, or you can stream all of our programs online at checkoutjazz.org. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Checkout Jazz. The producer is Simon Rentner, at Simon Rentner. Special thanks to our intern, Joyce Kwan. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Josh Jackson. Thanks for listening.